Sometimes I feel like the actual James Shapiro is in the next room writing the next book, and he pays me to do these public appearances.
There's a whole other Shakespearean theme of identity we can discuss.
Exactly.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, and now in its 19th year, number 975, Shakespearean James Shapiro. James Shapiro is probably my favorite Shakespearean scholar and author. His books, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, 1599, The Year of Lear, Shakespeare in 1606, and Shakespeare in a Divided America, What His Plays Tell Us About Our Past and Future, are invaluable and highly readable studies of Shakespeare's plays, the times they were written in, and how they've resonated throughout history and continue to resonate today. Jim also serves as consultant to New York's Public Theater, which reopens its newly renovated Delacorte Theater in Central Park this week with a star-studded production of Twelfth Night, starring Lupita Nyong'o as Viola, Sandra Oh as Olivia, Jesse Tyler Ferguson as Sir Andrew, and Peter Dinklage as Malvolio. And that was the perfect excuse to have this very fun conversation. My first question was about this Shakespearean theme of identity. I wanted to talk to you about titles. You are a professor of English at Columbia University. I think of you as a historian and one of our most eminent Shakespeareans, but our mutual friend Daniel Pollack Pelsner refers to you as a mensch. Do you have a preference for any of these honorifics?
You know, it's a very good question. One of my other labels or identities is Shakespeare scholar in residence at the Public Theater. And the actors don't really get what that means. So I just say I'm the Shakespeare guy in the room. And I'm always happiest with that designation. Sure, I do a little cultural history, but to historians, I'm not an historian. Right. To my colleagues in English, I do too much theater. To my colleagues in theater, I'm not in the School of Arts. So I'm always a little bit outside, which is a very good place to be.
I wanted to ask about that, about the working at the Public. You've worked with so many actors at the Public and in various productions. Do you find yourselves in yourself in rehearsal learning from the actors?
I learn a spectacular amount from the actors. I'll give the most recent example. I was in rehearsal Saturday, 2 days ago, and Peter Dinklage is playing Malvolio brilliantly. And one of the most crucial lines in Twelfth Night is, "I'll be revenged on the pack of you." And he did that in a different way that I won't describe because the show hasn't opened yet, and it might change. But it was so brilliant that it opened up not just that line, but the ending of the play for me in ways that I hadn't understood. And I thanked him for it afterwards. He's a brilliant performer. So I learn a tremendous amount of being in the room. In exchange, I share what I know. I'll give you an example of that. Some years ago in a production of Troilus and Cressida that Dan Sullivan was directing, the actor playing Troilus used the word thou. And thou is a very common word and people think they know what it means, even though it has a kind of King James Bible-y quality to it. But thou could either be a term of intimacy or a put down in Elizabethan England. And, you know, I could tell the actors as I used to think of French or German languages in which vous, to those words have different connotations. But I cut past that. And when the actor playing Troilus used the word, I said, That's not a nice thou. That's an F-U thou, using the full four-letter word. And once you say that, actors get it. Oh, that's an F-U thou. Okay, I got it. And he nailed it. And it just changed the scene.
Yeah.
So you wonder what happens when you don't have someone in the room who has that knowledge, who lives 400 years ago, as I do sometimes, and can give actors the tools they need. Yeah. And once they have that, it pops and the scene works. And otherwise, audiences kind of are checking their cell phones, thinking about what they're going to have for dinner after the show. So it's consequential. And I should also say, there are not five people I would allow in a rehearsal room who have PhDs in literature, because they go into the room and say, Hamlet is about a man who can't make up his mind, or other nonsense, the kind of stuff we get paid to do in a classroom with 20-year-olds. That's useless for actors. But yeah. Actors want to know is, what do the words mean? What conventions don't I understand? What is going on on this page that No Fear Shakespeare doesn't explain?
Well, I love that use of thou and that example. One of the things I say to young actors all the time is, just imagine you are using the gerund effing in every single line, because that level of, and then that frequently helps them go, oh, okay, I get it. I got to dial it up.
Yeah. And I use the word often. In a way, I have to remind them that I'm not the guy who wrote the book somebody gave them for Christmas, but somebody who loves this language and can explain it. And the best actors, Sandra Oh and Lupita, are in this production of Twelfth Night, and they were just wrestling with a pair of lines that they speak. And I brought in Shakespeare's first sonnet that kind of resonated with those lines. They're students, they're scholars of Shakespeare, and they got it. And now when I listen to them in that scene, it's so much richer. Mm-hmm. It's because they're inside of what Shakespeare was not just writing, but thinking at that moment about the need to give yourself up in marriage to somebody, not to withhold yourself, the stuff that the first 17 sonnets are about, and also enters into the exchange between Viola and Olivia in the play. So it's really thrilling when you get to work with superstars, and they're superstars for a reason.
Right.
They do their homework, they're gifted, they have great ear, they have great timing, they are quick studies, they know how to take what's useful and reject what's not.
Do you work with frequently with, shall I say, celebrities that are coming to Shakespeare new, relatively untested? What do you do with those folks?
You know, here's a good example, a recent example for me. I got to work with Denzel Washington and Jake Gyllenhaal on the Broadway Othello.
Wow.
And Jake was pretty much new to Shakespeare. And Denzel has been doing this. He played Othello a half century ago. So it wasn't his first rodeo. And he considers himself a stage actor before a movie star.
Yeah.
So they just had completely different approaches. Jake was off book before day one. He consulted with me and others so that he knew what, not only what every word meant, but what some of the major Iagos in the last 25 years have chosen to do, have inflected in certain ways. Mm. And that's not how Denzel works. Denzel can draw upon a lot of experience as an actor, as a Shakespeare actor. So my job is simply to be available, mm-hmm. and otherwise keep a low profile and stay out of the way, and never, ever, ever suggest a line reading to an actor, and never applaud during rehearsals. I once applauded F. Murray Abraham, who's playing Shylock, the best Shylock I've ever seen for theater for an audience. And he was just brilliant. And I just applauded. And he came over to me very angry. And he said, "Don't ever applaud. If you're applauding, I think it's good. And I stop working to make it better. Don't do that in rehearsal." And he was quite shocked with me. And he was right. I mean, I don't know. Unlike you, I've never directed. I can't act. My Brooklyn accent, Shakespeare didn't write like Arthur Miller did, plays for those with a thick Flatbush accent. So it's not for me. But I still make mistakes. And I apologize when I do.
Hi, I'm Daniel Pollack Pelsner, author of Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist. And you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall of 2025, we'll be touring all the great books abridged at various venues we'll announce soon, and the ultimate Christmas show abridged in Washington State at the Edmonds Center for the Arts on December 3rd and the Capitol Theater in Yakima on December 12th. Sign up for our newsletter or check out the touring page at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with James Shapiro, just as we were interrupted by my wife, D. Ryan.
Hi.
This is my wife, D. Ryan. Jim Shapiro.
How are you?
Super fan. I'm a super fan. Oh, my God.
Even worse. Even worse than
Thank
me.
Thank you. Did you tell her that the real Jim Shapiro's in the next room?
That's right. We haven't got to that point.
Oh, wait. What?
This is the clone.
Disappointed. I want you to ask him, do you feel that Shakespeare in that first chapter in Shakespeare in
a divided
America, do you have any changed thoughts about the commonality of culture in America after now that we're in Trump's second term?
That's a great question. And I think about the opening and concluding chapters of that book where I talk about Oscar Eustace's 2017 Julius Caesar with the Donald Trump stand-in as Caesar. What I didn't understand when I wrote that and published it in 2020 was what I was watching was a dress rehearsal of the assault on the Capitol. And one decision I made in writing that book was to bury in the end notes the name of the individual who rushed onto the stage and the individual who filmed that person during the first disruption. The name of the person who rushed the stage was Laura Loomer. Now, Donald Trump's right-hand advisor and Jack Posobiec, another right-winger, these people were dismissed as clowns back in 2017, and now they are wreaking havoc with our democracy. So if I ever get to do a 20th anniversary edition of that, one, I'll be a very old man, but two, I will, unless there's censorship across the land, make clear what I didn't see. Because the overriding principle that animates everything I've written about Shakespeare is we read newspapers to find out what happened that day, but we can turn to Shakespeare to try to understand what's really at stake and the larger issues that are not necessarily grasped in the moment or by journalists. People love Shakespeare. Left, right, center, old and young.
Yeah.
The challenge we collectively face is how to continue to make it meaningful and appealing. And if we fail at that, shame on us.
Yeah, it's almost as if we have to get out of Shakespeare's way a little bit. Yeah. You know, we can only make it unappealing if we do it if we do it wrong. I mean, that makes it sound easy, which it's not. Do you find yourself advising on productions where you're going, please, you're going down that unappealing, over intellectual path?
I have told directors who'll go nameless, especially, you know, I don't just do Broadway or Delacorte outdoor theater productions. One of my responsibilities over the last decade or so for the public theater has been advising productions that go into prisons. So these are 90-minute versions, equity actors, eight of them. I have to cut the text and double it up so that eight actors can do it.
Right.
But sometimes directors want to give a 40-line speech. And I try to tell them first politely and then slightly less politely, nobody's going to be able to absorb a 40-line speech. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. And, oh, but I love this speech is the response. And I love it too. But you have to work from where your audiences are and meet them halfway. Yeah. No audience nowadays wants to see a four-hour play. And I don't think in Shakespeare's day they would have stood for a four-hour Hamlet. In the middle of March, it would have been dark by 5 o'clock and Burbage would have been stabbed to death in the final scene. So That doesn't work. So you have to kind of figure out what's the right length and do you have an intermission? How do you get the energy back up? How do you frame the play? The first 10 minutes for most people of any Shakespeare play, it's like old folks tuning in with fuzzy hearing aids. They're not hearing what's going on. So how do you adjust before the audience tunes itself to Shakespeare? So these are really practical concerns they never teach you in graduate school.
Well, it's true, and they do, and often in English departments, they don't think of it. They don't think of it having to be a show and thinking like a showman.
Exactly, and you know, there are two kind of Shakespeareans. Those who think that Shakespeare wrote for the page and those who think he wrote for the stage. And I grow increasingly impatient with those who think it's about the page. I don't believe it for one, but Just in practical terms, so you want to forget 90% of people who are interested in Shakespeare? Fine.
Yeah. I just read Contested Will. I thought I was rereading it. And it turns out, as I realized, no, hang on. I've never actually read this before. So it was fascinating, fascinating. And it was almost like a revenge tragedy because you take us through all these horrible, stupid theories, and you don't judge them. You just present them, and then you bring the hammer down in such a satisfying revenge movie way.
Very true. I'll admit to it now. I wouldn't have 6 months after the book came out. 6 months after the book came out, I got a letter from the Supreme Court of the United States. I thought it was jury duty before I realized they don't do jury duty in the Supreme Court. I tore it open, and it was a letter from Justice Stevens, who was Oxfordian of the Year and didn't think that Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare. Hmm. And he noted that the six signatures are all wobbly. And he wanted to know what I thought, having read Contested Will. And I wrote back saying, with all due respect, I noticed that you neither typed the letter nor signed the letter. And it's extraordinary to me that, like Shakespeare, you are functionally illiterate and had such a distinguished career on the bench as a functional illiterate, because the same argument holds with you. And I thought that'd be the end of it. And he wrote back and I wrote back. And we went back and forth for 6 months until I ghosted him, because I said, look, you can believe that the Earl of Oxford wrote the plays following this man's Loney's theories, which are fundamentally undemocratic, or you can believe in democracy. You can't believe both. So just choose. And he said, I can believe in both. And I said, no, you can't. Our conversation is over. And I sent the correspondence to the Folger Shakespeare Library for posterity to know just how and when our Supreme Court went off the rails. But Alito is a Shakespeare denier. Scalia was. It tells you a lot about people who think they know what evidence is. So what's happening today in the courts is no surprise to me.
It's the Shakespeare in the coal mine.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. Well, speaking of a democratic and Shakespearean humble origins, how did you come to Shakespeare?
I went to junior high in Brooklyn, New York, had as bad a Shakespeare experience as you could possibly imagine at the age of 14, swore I would never study Shakespeare formally again in college or after, and I never did. But you're almost old enough to know that Freddie Laker used to fly people from New York City to London for 99 each way back in the 70s. I flew over with my brother. We bummed around youth hostels and stuff. The cheapest entertainment you could find was going to see Shakespeare in London or Stratford, 50 pence a night, a buck a night. You could sleep in a youth hostel for a dollar. And it was so thrilling. It was like a drug that was cheaper than the other drugs that we couldn't quite afford in those days. And every summer, I'd hold down some crummy job as a street messenger selling Guatemalan handicrafts, quit August 1st, fly over, see 25 plays in 25 days. After about 5 years, I'd only Shakespeare and Stoppard. So I'd seen over 200 productions. They're all tattooed inside my skull. And they're invaluable for when I speak with actors today saying, well, when Jonathan Pryce played Hamlet in 1981, he did this, and feeds right into productions.
Well, and tellingly, you discovered Shakespeare where he should be discovered, on the stage.
The only place, the only place. I require my Columbia undergraduates to see a live production and write about it. Because unless they do that, they're not going to get it. They just don't. And I also, even though it's an English class, not a theater class, everybody has to get up, embarrass themselves, and act things out. And you act out the same scene in two ways, and you ask the class which is better. And they have tremendous judgment. They just never thought that it could be done in more than one way. So that is liberating for young minds.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing that involves Jake Gyllenhaal's dad, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. The public theater production of Twelfth Night opens this week at the newly renovated Delacorte Theater in New York Central Park. Go to publictheater.org for more information. And of course, James Shapiro's invaluable books are available at your favorite bookstore or library. Send us what you learned from F. Murray Abraham via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks as always to cross-gartered Puritan Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Joanna Brigden. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Daniel Pollock Pelsner, the author of Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist, especially for introducing me to my favorite Shakespeare guy. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 975 2925ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. One of my first film audition, I think it might have been my first film audition, 30 years ago, was for Jake Gyllenhaal's dad here in Chicago. And I was just auditioning to play an emergency room doctor, and I did not get the part. But he said, that was great. Just slow it down a little bit. And I slowed it down. And he went, that was great. Now slow it down even more. And I did. And he stayed with me for 10 minutes. He took 10 minutes of time just going, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down, slow down. And he went, that's what it needs to be. And I walked out of there and I didn't get the part, but he didn't need to do that. He did not need to spend that time with a dopey actor.
The pros, the top people, are the most patient and the most committed. And I saw that with Jake. I saw it with Denzel. I saw it with Murray. I'm seeing it now with Sandra Oh, Peter Dinklage. you can learn so much by watching. I'll give one last example. We did our first two run-throughs of Twelfth Night, Saeem Ali's Twelfth Night, this past week. And it's going to open in previews on the 7th, so it was time. And in two of those performances, a lead actor was out, and an understudy had to step in. And this is early. It's early enough so in most productions, the leads would not be fully off book.
And let alone the understudies.
Let alone the understudies. And I expected them to have a script in hand.
Yeah.
Each of these understudies was off book and had perfectly imitated the blocking and mannerisms of those they were standing in for. And it was brilliant, but what was so moving to me was all the principals gathered around each of them on successive days and applauded them until they blushed and cheered and acknowledged that their doing that raised the level of the run through. And audiences don't get to see this, but this is what happens in theater. And this is why I'll continue to work until they lock me out and change the combination.
Another great edit point. Tell the other Jim Shapiro in the other room that this Jim Shapiro is really good at what he does.
I will do that. He asked me to blur the background so you can't see him moving around.
This podcast is a production of the Reduce Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reduceshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.